Okay, so this is the last content lecture before the midterm. So the next lecture period we'll have will actually be the midterm review. So schedule is here. We've got before the midterm, we've got this ARE, this reading assignment perusal for this unit on communication, as well as the Canvas comprehension exercise. Those are due this weekend. Make sure to do your lockdown browser compliance test as soon as possible, just to make sure everything's working fine so that you're ready for stage one. Once you do that, then we'll unlock the midterm module and all the resources within it, including a practice exam, the exam from last fall, as well as a bunch of other resources that might be helpful. So our timeline here is today we'll finish up communication. Then Thursday we'll do the midterm review. So bring your questions to that. Otherwise, if you don't have questions or if there's a slowdown, I'll have kind of the greatest hit slides from each one. So it's kind of the big things that I want you to take away from each of the lectures that we'd have this semester so far. And I can go through those, but they're just mainly meant to generate questions. So if you bring questions, we'll just work on the questions. But if otherwise we can go through those, when questions come up, you can bring them up. But that's kind of the plan for Thursday, just a review session for that. And then I understand that Sean and Anushka had planned some review sessions. Maybe that's already happened. Maybe it's but the announcements are organized with that. And then next week we got stage one is scheduled for Tuesday and stage two for Thursday. I'm going to make stage one available Monday and Tuesday. I'll decide by Thursday. By the midterm review, what I'll do on Wednesday. But at least stage one will be Monday and Tuesday, and stage two, Thursday and Friday. So those will be the availability windows for that. So for stage one, because it's timed, anytime during the availability window, once you start it, then you've got 90 minutes to finish it. So if you want to come here during the normal class period on Tuesday, that's fine. Just bring a laptop so that you can do that Canvas-based exam. If you don't want to do that, you want to do it at home or somewhere else, Gesundheit, then you can. That's also fine. Just it'll be on lockdown browser. And so that's the plan for stage one. Closed book, closed notes, individual exam. You can have that one sheet of notes and some scrap paper. That one sheet of notes, it's double-sided. I say handwritten or hand-produced. If you want to draw graphs and things like that, that's fine. I just don't want you to take screenshots of things that I've given you or that come out of the textbook. So you can produce something on your own computer and take a screenshot of that, but I don't want it to be just, figure 4.6 out of the book. It's immediately taken out of that or whatever. So that's the idea there. Just want it to be built by you in order to be put onto that note sheet. Then on stage two, which will be Thursday of that week, that's collaborative. So if you want to come to class during the class period, you can. You don't have to. You don't have to collaborate. You can take it alone. You won't get your scores or the solutions in between stage one and stage two. Stage two will be the exact same exam as stage one, but your score will be 80% your closed note individual score plus 20% your stage two score. So if you want to come in then and work with people during this class period, that's fine. Usually we get a small fraction of people to come in and do that. So a lot of times we'll get like a group of people working together and maybe a group of people working alone and then everybody else working elsewhere. Just whatever modality you want to use, Discord, Slack, Gesundheit, anything else, that's fine just as long as the only people on that channel are other people enrolled in this course. So that's the schedule looking forward. We can talk more about that on Thursday, but any general questions about that layout? Yep. Yeah, so this one sheet is double-sided, one sheet of notes, hand-produced. Anything else? Okay. No. So stage one will be open all of Monday and all of Tuesday. And so once you start it, you'll have 90 minutes to finish it, but you can start it anytime during that Monday or Tuesday. I'm leaning towards making stage one Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and then stage two Thursday, Friday. If for some reason you've got a good argument that Well, it makes more sense to have, stage two Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, or something like that. Let me know. But it seems a little arbitrary to me, and so I feel like providing a little more flexibility on the timed exam might be a little bit better. So that doesn't really matter to me. But I'm leaning towards stage one Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, stage two Thursday, Friday. But I'm still finishing up the exam, so once it's released, it's released, and so it doesn't matter to me. But definitely Monday, Tuesday, and definitely Thursday, Friday. Other questions? Okay. Let's, I think, just to emphasize this point about the lockdown browser, let's give you an early multiple choice. So, same question I asked at the end of last time. Have you completed the lockdown browser compliance test on Canvas yet? Yes, or you're planning on it. So, just fill that in, get your credit there, yes or no. I'll leave that up here. Okay. Get my control back of PowerPoint. All right. Okay, so closing off the communication chapter here. So today we're sort of going to talk about the last kind of complex communication topics that kind of bring everything together and involve a little bit of exploitation of communication and interspecific communication. So communication creates there's opportunities for more sophisticated information processing. Once you've got communication, you can start sharing information and doing stuff with it as a group. Allows for some cool things to happen there, but it also allows for more vulnerabilities for animals to exploit. So those are kind of the things that we're going to focus on here today. So we'll start on the kind of good side of this. And so honeybee example. So I'm a little afraid to use this mouse here because then it'll stop the video, but let me see if I can do it here. So the painted individual here is doing what's called a waggle dance. And so she's kind of moving in a figure eight pattern. So here's a cartoon version of it. So she'll wiggle her little butt, move around in a figure eight, come and do another one of these waggle runs and come around. So she's doing this where she kind of moves in roughly the same direction and keeps doing these figure eight patterns. And as she does that, and as others in the colony here are doing that, then you can see that there are other bees that are following her, kind of feeling around her as she does this pattern. And so this is a highly stereotyped behavior. When this was first, when Von Frisch was first staring at these things, then it was pretty clear that this was not just sort of an accidental kind of interaction among bees trying to get around each other. This seemed, again, stereotyped. It seemed like it could be communication. And over time, it was learned that it was communication, that they are communicating something. So what are they communicating? So I'll leave this up. Does everybody see the waggle dance? If you've never seen it before, I just want to make sure I leave it up here so that it's pretty clear. The painted bees here doing these waggle dances. And so they're painted as they've come back from a so they've flown out, they've gone to a feeder, they've been painted, they come back to the hive, and then when they come back to the hive, they have information about where that feeder is, and then you can watch how they interact with their nestmates back at the hive. So the basic idea here is you've got this waggle, and it has an angle relative to vertical. So if you orient these combs vertically, then there's gravity pointing down, and you can dance relative to up and down. So if you're on a vertical surface, you can gr dance straight up and down the wall, or you can dance at an angle of the wall. So you dance at some angle with vertical. And it turns out that that angle strongly correlates to the angle of the flower that the bee was at relative to where the sun is in the sky. So if you drop the sun in the sky and then you paint a line on from the tree where the bees live to the horizon where the sun is, then the angle that they're dancing relative to vertical is highly correlates to this angle relative to where the flowers are. So this angle that the bees can choose to dance is communicating a direction to where the flowers are. And what's crazy is that as the sun moves throughout the sky, the bees are apparently able to use an internal clock to recalibrate so that they can continue to dance for the right flowers, even though their reference sun is moving. So they have a lot of information stored in this angle here that is dynamically managed inside the behavior of the bee dancing for this. And on top of that, then you can see that the duration of the waggle run, so how long they do this waggle dance, is correlated to the distance to the food source. So short waggle runs have to do, so you've got here timing. So how many seconds are they doing that? There is this really nice pattern where every, second or so you go up about 1,000 meters. So they're able to communicate polar coordinates, distance and direction from their location to a source of flowers or potentially a source of a new nest. So they not only use this for foraging, they also use this for choosing a new nest when it's time to move on to a new nest, as in after reproduction events and so on. I won't go into details about that. But point is, it is clearly a ritualized, communication mechanism that is used to communicate a very complex set of information, the waggle dance. So, any questions about the waggle dance? It's usually something people have seen before already, so maybe this is old news, but just want to make sure that we're clear about how this works before we drill down and think a little more deeply about it. Okay. So, really cool behavior that these honeybees do to coordinate with each other, to communicate with each other. And I was trying to prevent myself from saying this word ahead of time, but we refer to this as an encoding. So, they have encoded information. What do we mean by that? They've translated information from one form into a symbolic signal. That's what we mean by a code. It's a symbolic signal. So this dance, the angle with the vertical and the duration of the waggle run, that is a code. It is completely arbitrary. In fact, other species use a different encoding. There are cavity nesters like these European honeybees that they are coordinated so that their angle is, like I said, it's like I just with vertical. But there are open nesting bees that live on, so they have these big hives that are out on trees. So they're not inside a cavity. So they aren't on vertical surfaces. And they actually do their waggle runs directed at the flowers. And so it's not an angle relative to vertical translates to an angle relative to the sun. It's just, no, the flower's over there. So they do their waggle runs toward the flower. And then they turn around and then they do it again toward the flower. So that's just a different choice of code. Either way, it is a symbolic representation of information. And that's what we mean by a code. So that's what we mean by encoding. So when we talk about codes, we can ask, well, how much information is in that code? So, like if you put flowers at 100 different locations, could the bees really discriminate or communicate to another bee one flower versus another if they were really close together? So we'd like to know how much information is in the code. And so we have a way to measure that. And so we refer to bits of information. This was borrowed from computer engineers, from communications engineers, from somebody named Shannon. And we use it with animal communication as well. So when we talk about a bit of coded information, then what we're saying here is that the information content is equivalent to the number of yes/no questions necessary to describe the response to a signal. And the bits are that, so if I say there's 5 bits of information, then that means there's 5 yes/no questions that are encoded in that. What do I mean by that? I've got some examples down here. If you notice that you're watching followers to these dances, and you watch where they fly out. So a bee comes back from a feeder She does the waggle dance, and then followers fly out, and they're going to fly out towards flowers that she came from. Now, you might notice that of all the bees that are coming back, there are generally flowers roughly everywhere, but the bees that fly out, if they follow a bee, they may not go exactly in one direction. So you might have six followers following the same bee. Some of them go that way, some of them go that way. So this bee is effectively sending followers to this large sector. So she's not encoding a tiny flower there, she's encoding this large section. So she's definitely not encoding over there, but she's encoding this large area. So then we can ask, like, okay, if that's the limit of her precision, then how many flowers or how many regions could she count? Well, we can just say, well, how, if you look at the periphery, how many of these can you fit into there? And if you can fit five of those, then we would say well, that's the limit of the information there. She can't communicate more than five things to her followers. And then we'd say, how many yes, no questions? Well, it turns out for if five, you can do that with three yes, no questions. So it's kind of like with two yes, no questions, you can communicate four things. So to get one more, you need at least one more yes, no question, because every yes, no question allows you to communicate two things. So one question times another question, two times two gives you four, times another question, two times two times two, that gives you eight, and so on. So that's the way in which we communicate the number of, yes, no questions. It's this logarithmic thing where it's like, 20 questions. You can actually do a lot in 20 questions. So usually if you're playing 20 questions, you can get something probably in a lot fewer than that, because 20 bits of information is a lot of information. So here, if flowers, followers go to four locations with dances seeming to predict which of the four they go to, then we say the dance has two bits of information. That's two, because it's two times two gives us four. So we have two questions. One of the questions is it an odd sight or an even sight? And then once you know it's an odd sight, then you can say, all right, so from one, two, three, and four, if it's an odd sight, then is it going to be one or three? Or if it's an even sight, is it going to be two or four? So our two questions tell us where we are. Like, if it's an odd sight, yes, then that's great. We know it's either one or three. So the other question tells us which one of those. So that's what I mean by two questions. And so it's the minimal number of questions you need to describe the number of things that we see the animals discriminating. So it takes observing a lot of communication to be able to figure out how many bits of communication are in those. But with species like honeybees, it's very possible to watch them do lots and lots of these dances. And then you can figure out, if you watch all the followers for one dance, you can figure out how high the resolution, like how narrow can a bee send other bees? And that helps you figure out how many bits of information are in this code. So that's the rough idea. To make it a little more quantitative, what we do is if you can count up how many different sites that you can send honeybees to with one dance, then if you take the logarithm base two, that will tell you how many yes/no questions it takes at the minimum in order to communicate that. And we could just use M. We could just use the number of sites as an information content. But we learned from the communications engineers that, and from the physicists, that if you use the log of it, then it makes it make more sense downstream as you start combining different communication modalities, for example. So, for example, let's just say that, so I mentioned that the honeybee communicates distance and direction. Well, we could say how many distances. We can say what is the information content of the distance channel. We can then also ask how many directions. So how many bits are in the direction communication? So then if we want to know how many bits of information are in both together, then we would normally need to multiply those things. And that just gets kind of ugly. We'd like them to be able to add. And that's why we use the logarithm. So the idea here is you have 16 distances. That's 4 bits. There's 4 questions that you need to resolve 16 options. And then you could say, well, if there's 4 different direction possibilities, well, that's 2 bits. You need 2 questions to resolve 4 directions. So overall, 16 times 4 is 64 possibilities. Well, rather than keep multiplying these things, we can just add the number of questions. We can say, well, there's 4 questions from the distances, there's 2 questions from the directions. So if we have 6 questions, we resolve all of the distances and all of the directions. So the reason we use bits is it allows us to add things together. So we can say, how much is the color encoding? How much is the sound encoding? How much is some other aspect of behavior encoding? And we get bits, bits, and bits. And then we say, well, what's the total information content? You add all the bits. And that addition is enabled by this logarithm. So just a little bit of math, but it all comes down to how many questions, if we were to convert a waggle dance into a 20 questions game, then how many questions would we need in order to do the work of the waggle dance? Questions about that? Big thing I want you to take away, if you hear bits referred to when we talk about communication, again, a bit is the amount of information in a yes/no question. So imagine animals, instead of communicating with color and sound and whatever, transform them into a universe where you can hear how they're communicating, but they only communicate in yes/no questions. They're only playing 20 questions. And in that world, then this quantity tells us how many questions on average they're going to be communicating with each other with in order to say the same things. Okay. So with the waggle dance and with a collective group, what can you do at the colony level? And when you combine communication with feedback in groups, then you get some really interesting collective behavior. So this is a time series where we've got a time at, let's say, noon, and then a time down here at 5 p.m. These are one honeybee colony, and they can watch where the foragers are going, and they can see that there are two sites where there's flowers, one at Devil's Glen, the other at Broad Cove. So you can see that early on, you get the same number of foragers at both sites, same number at both sites, same number at both sites. But then over time, you start noticing that Devil's Glen gets slightly more bees. And you start noticing Broad Cove gets slightly less bees. And by the evening, all the bees are at Devil's Glen and none of them are at Broad Cove. So what you've got here is not only is a bee telling another bee that I really like this particular area, I think there's some good stuff there, but if that bee is more enthusiastic about that area, then and other bees agree with her, then they'll dance for that area enthusiastically and gradually will suck all of the foragers over into that area. So what you're seeing here is a colony making a choice. Every individual bee can still go to both areas, but over time, gradually all of the bees start going to one area. And it's as if the colony had some sort of centralized decision maker saying, let's all forage there. But there wasn't anybody centralized in the colony sending them that way. It was just happening through word of mouth, through these bees or word of dance. And so via the waggle dance, the whole colony ends up exploiting the better area. And that's kind of a neat thing that happens here. And by the way the bees encode enthusiasm is there's not only the length of a waggle run, but there's how many times they do that figure eight. And so if they're doing those figure eights for 10 minutes, that might be they're really enthusiastic versus doing those figure eights for a minute. So bees can be not only communicate distance and direction, but they can also communicate enthusiasm. And so that's, another kind of interesting thing to add into this. So, collective intelligence here of the bees. Any question about that dynamic and how communication enables that? Information processing in groups. Okay. All right. So, questions in general, complex behaviors, communication, encoding, lots of things. It's not on and off anymore. It's now we're encoding very fine-grained information. Well, so when you look at the waggle here, so the length here encodes a distance, the angle here encodes a direction, and how many or how long they end up doing these figure eights encodes the quality of the site. So you're getting three dimensions of information there, an orientation, a distance, and a quality. All right. And an interesting thing about the quality thing is a follower of the bee doesn't actually have to be aware of the quality here. A follower might only follow her for a few seconds and then be able to go off. And so that's the other beautiful thing about collective intelligence is no one individual necessarily has to be aware of all the information. As far as we know, the way quality signals are incorporated is through what we refer to as demographics. So the idea here is if this bee dances for 10 minutes for a site, she's going to recruit a lot of followers. So the quality signal isn't actually being transmitted to an individual follower. An individual follower isn't going to follow her for 10 minutes, but she's going to collect a lot of followers if she's dancing for 10 minutes. So quality signals may be encoded in the behavior, but the receiver is a little more complex. The receiver is almost not even aware that they're receiving the signal. It's almost like the receiver is the colony, not an individual bee for quality. Sean, were you about to say something? So ask a biologist if you've never seen it. Great resource that ASU maintains. A lot of information about lots of different animals, not just the honeybees, but they've got some cool interactive tools that have been developed relatively recently on the waggle dance. So take a look. Ask a biologist. Okay. So any other questions about the waggle dance, bits of information, encodings? Great. Okay. With that, let's do one more multiple or one more short answer. So, good little midterm question here. What is the name of the unit that represents the amount of information and a yes/no question? So, it's looking for a simple word, a very short word, a word borrowed from engineering that we now use in animal behavior. Okay, so I'll leave that up for a little bit. All right, so moving away from bees, complex communication. This was an example that really bothered Darwin. So the peacock. So here's a peacock here. Here's a peahen that's down here. Peacock is presenting to the peahen. Darwin looked at this. Darwin's just starting to figure out natural selection and says, you know what? The sight of a feather in a peacock's tail, whenever I gaze at it, makes me sick. It just doesn't make sense to him. It's clearly very costly. It doesn't appear to impart any function, but it looks also like it's so stereotyped then it's got to be the output of some selective process. It does not happen accidentally. It does not fall into normal physiological variation that he was aware of. And so, like I said, it made him sick. Over time, people started to get a handle of this and said, there is a possibility here of sexual selection leading to something we call a Fisherian runaway. So, runaway sexual selection. So, the idea here is what if you had one sex that really liked a trait in a directional way, like so preferred large amounts of that trait in that sex? Well, then that would lead to those with larger amounts of that trait having more success. And that would lead potentially to then there being an even greater desire for even greater amounts of that, leading to a positive feedback, a vicious cycle here, where you've got relatively extreme trait value in one sex leads to a preference for that value in the other sex, leads to even more trait value in that sex, and over again. And this can potentially explain this explosion of this trait that is almost comical. Because it just looks, extremely costly, but extremely showy, but potentially driven by this sexual selection process, the hypothesized Fisherian runaway, when traits in one sex are magnified beyond any reasonable scale because of preferences the other. It was that reasonable scale that made Darwin sick. He just said that I can't attribute a function to this. There's no seed that this bird now can access because it's got these big feathers, but I can't explain how these big feathers could possibly be sticking around. So what's going on there? And this was a possible answer to that. And we can use that to not only explain this sexual dimorphism, but a lot of other sexual dimorphisms. And so we can look at, for example, in these bighorn sheep, male versus female, they both have got these horns. The males are much, much larger, don't appear to provide a lot of immediate function, but potentially could be preferred by the female. And if they're preferred by the female, males, and they have offspring that produce large ones, then it can lead to this runaway problem. Or I don't want to call it a problem, but, and it doesn't have to be size. It can also be color. So, if you look at these are both mallards. So these are both. One's female down here, one's male up here. Male's completely different coloration. Again, the extreme sexual dimorphism here. One hypothesis for this is that it comes from a Fisherian runaway. So, runaway sexual selection driving these two sexes apart. That's one possibility there. That's the idea behind here. I'm getting back to arthropods. So these jumping spiders, these adorable little critters here. So the males, in fact, this is actually a peacock jumping spider. So its abdomen back here, it can lift up like a peacock and display to the female. And and there's this Maratus genus. You can find some really cool patterns that are displayed on the males. Here's the female over here, very brown color. Again, the thought is here that this extreme sexual dimorphism can be driven by runaway sexual selection, Fisherian runaway. So that's the idea there. But there might be some function that you end up getting out of this. And so initially, when, so this is, Fisher, we're talking about, 40s, 50s, 60s, people are starting to think about this and they're thinking, it could just be sexual selection just driving these things sort of to an unreasonable amount. But over time, people started thinking about this and said, actually, this type of sexual signaling may lead to something that is functional. And that's what we'll get to here in a second. But does everybody understand the basic idea, at least the early idea here about runaway sexual selection? Extreme dimorphism just driven by positive feedback. Okay. So, the idea here, though, is well, extreme traits like this moose with these antlers up here. On one hand, they could just be extreme traits. But on the other hand, once you've got them, it actually speaks to a characteristics of the animal. This is a really costly thing to carry around on your head. If it gets to the point where it's so costly that only certain types of males can manage to pay that cost, then the existence of the costly signal actually becomes an honest signal of the quality of the male. So it doesn't become an arbitrary signal. It becomes a signal that actually communicates something honest that is very difficult to find honesty. Because if it's just, the production of blue, if it's cheap to produce blue, then you're just going to see blue produced by every male or every female in the species. And so, at that point, like there could be a frequency dependent thing where, well, once everybody's blue, then maybe now it becomes attractive to be red or something along those lines. But if it's just directional, like if it's cheap to produce blue, then why doesn't everybody just become blue and then eventually that preference go away? What happens here is that it's not cheap to produce these antlers. And because it's not cheap to produce those antlers, then only certain types of individuals can produce them. And so the presence of the antlers is not arbitrary. It actually is communicating something about paying costs. And so it's like, if you want to participate in the mating game, there's an entry cost. So that's kind of the thought here, is that honest signals reflect paying an entry cost. So, this male is worth it, worth considering because they paid the cost. It's an honest signal of their health is to be able to produce that up there. So this is the idea that we've talked about before, the handicap principle. Costly characteristics are reliable signals because individuals can only pay those costs if they've got enough in the bank. So it's a form of conspicuous consumption in the animal world. So, do a certain set of the human population buy, a certain class of expensive, loud, gaudy vehicles that themselves almost look cartoonish because not everybody can buy them. So if you can buy them, it potentially says something about you. Now, as we're going to get to at the end here, of course, you can take out car loans, you can be over-leveraged, and so on. And so there are going to be people who cheat the system. But most of the time, the only way to produce these conspicuous signals is if you can pay for them. And that's the idea of the handicap principle. So down here, there's the kind of a corollary is the handicap principle suggests that all secondary sexual characteristics must be costly. So as a review, we talk about primary sexual characteristics, the things that make, two sexes differentiate at birth. Secondary sexual characteristics, the things you start seeing expressed around puberty, going into adulthood. And I think those of you familiar with secondary sexual characteristics might be able to see how this plays out, that, it's not cheap to carry around secondary sexual characteristics. They can lead to back problems. They can lead to all sorts of things that make it, it's just costly to have and almost seems, they're not providing function, so it seems like it's all cost. What you're feeling there is hypothetically, so theoretically here, is the handicap principle, is that if secondary sexual characteristics are thought to be signaling, morphs, so they're thought to be signaling something. In order for a signal to be trusted as a sexual signal, the thought is it must be costly. And then so by the handicap principle, secondary sexual characteristics are theorized to have some cost. And then you're stuck with it. So that's the thought there. So any questions about this idea? Honest signaling. Is it clear what I mean by honesty? Like you can, if it was just a white patch on the shoulder, if it's really easy to generate, to express white in this fur, then that's not an honest signal. Any one of the individuals there could turn on the gene expression pattern for white. And if it costs the same as the expression pattern for brown, I mean, maybe it makes you more conspicuous to predators, but maybe there's no predators that, I mean, maybe, well, wolves or something like that. But that's the thing is that if it doesn't have a cost, everyone would do it. So in order for it to be a signal, in order for it to communicate a bit, in order for it to have a benefit to both the sender and the receiver, it has to have a cost to the sender. Otherwise, it would not have a benefit to the receiver. Is that clear? So we can drill down a little bit farther in that. You've seen some examples of that in the reading for this unit. So this cricket reading, Mace Heck. He talks about different ways that males can signal females and different ways that males that don't signal females can exploit the signals of other males. And mentions here that the study determined that courtship calling by a domesticus was over twice as energetically costly. So if you haven't read this yet, you can measure the metabolic cost of certain behaviors. You take an insect or an animal and you put them in a respirometry chamber and you watch or you measure how much carbon dioxide is produced by the animal. And that correlates to respiration. You can figure out how much energy is that animal burning. And so you can say, this type of call, how much energy does it burn? This type of call, how much energy does it burn? This sort of walking around looking for females without calling, how much energy does that burn? And what they found is that a particular type of calling in this cricket was nearly twice as energetically costly as advertisement calling per unit time, suggesting its importance as a more reliable indicator of a signaler or mate. So cost gives us an inference of quality. So, as behavioral ecologists, this becomes a new tool that we can use. If you measure the cost of a signal, it gives us an insight into the value of the signal to a receiver. That's the idea behind the handicap principle. Questions about that? Is that clear what I mean by cost communicates value? So, if crickets are paying this amount of cost, they must be getting a significant benefit, or else they'd be doing something else. Okay. All right. So, other examples of that. So, rifle bird. So, this is an example of these beautiful courtship displays. If you've never seen these videos of these things, I encourage you to go to YouTube and look up some of these Victoria Rifle Bird courtship displays. Some people every once in a while like have these Halloween costumes where they'll dress up like that and they'll sort of dance like these rifle birds. So they have this sort of this posture and these iridescent patches, and they tilt up and down and they move around, and this iridescent patch, it glistens as they do this. The beautiful display that the males use to dance to the females. And they do this whole courtship display, and then the females choose from there. Extremely costly to produce all of the ornamentation that, that does all of this. It's costly in terms of energetics, and it's also very conspicuous. So it puts the bird at risk to do all this. So we think that that's what drives this as being a useful or an honest signal that isn't used during mating. So rifle, and that just goes for any courtship display. So here's the female, these are the males. Other examples of that, another Australian example, these bowerbirds. So here's the male, not super showy, but it has an extended phenotype. So it creates these bowers. It builds these large bowers here. And so not only does it create these like thatch bowers here, but then it also collects stones and a bunch of different items that it lays here. And certain types of bower birds have a preference for certain colors. So blue is a common one. So you'll just go to the find these bowers and you'll just find a bunch of blue things. Usually like, they'll be like baby pacifiers, like anything they can find is blue, it'll collect and bring back to here. So you get a bunch of these blues and you get this large thatch structure here. And then the male goes off and hides somewhere. And then a female comes by, she inspects the bower, and then she decides whether she's going to mate with the male or not based on the bower that the male has put together. So we refer to this as an extended phenotype. This is a trait of the male, the ability to put this together. Major G by E going on here, because the male's kind of got like a blueprint for how to put this together, but it depends upon finding stuff in the environment to actually put this thing in here. So, it is still a phenotype combining the blueprint inside the male with whatever it can find in the environment there, which also makes it an opportunity to be an honest signal of the quality of the male. Extremely costly to put together this thing, not functional at all in terms of providing, a nesting habitat for, chicks or anything like that. But it's this conspicuous cost that makes it a signaling element for courtship. So bowers. That's what we mean by bowers. So any question about what I've got pictured here? Like, to get to the male builds all of this and organizes all of this. It's pretty cool. And you can just find them like behind people's houses. You just walk down North Queensland and you go into somebody's backyard and next to their trash can, out a little bit into the forest, you find these bowers that are built by a bower bird looking for some love. So honest signals and the handicap principle. All right, and like I said, extended phenotype. So the phenotype is not something that has to be expressed on the animal. It can be something expressed outside. The way humans build structures, the structures we build are uniquely human. So that also reflects an extended phenotype. When aliens come to Earth, they can tell the difference between human-built structures and structures built by bower birds, because humans don't build things that look this way. So we have a ton of extended phenotypes that we push out into the world, as do certain animals. Okay. And then we've seen this one before. This applies to interspecific signaling as well, stotting. So we've got a prey animal here, it could run a lot faster and it would be sure to get away from its predator. But it also can do this little stotting behavior and still get away from its predator. So a prey that have this conspicuous, showy way to run away, it's costly to them, but it communicates to a predator that they're of very high quality in terms of escapability. And it's beneficial for the predator to pick up on that and go and pursue a different type of prey. So it's a benefit to the sender and the benefit of the receiver. So the word signal still applies here, even though it's interspecific. So we're also binning this into honest signals and handicap principle. If you're not fast enough to do this stotting, then you probably shouldn't do the stotting, because if you did, you'd be kind of quickly found out, and then the signal would lose its value. Okay. Questions about that? Complex signaling theory. All right, so let's round things out here. So one more of these, and then I've got a couple other examples, and then we'll be ready to move into the midterm. So one more multiple choice. Okay, so handicap principle suggests that all mating signals, so like, including secondary sexual characteristics, but also any other mating signals, should be what? According to the hypothesis of the handicap principle, should they all be brightly colored? Should they all be dull colored? Should they all be costly? Or they should all be multimodal? So according to the hypothesis of the handicap principle, what would we expect? What would be the prediction here? Costly, brightly colored, dull colored, or multimodal? So I'll give you a second there. And actually, I'll look at the distribution on this one. All right, so really strong peak at costly, and that's great. That's what I was looking for there. So signals should cost. Otherwise, they're not good signals. That's the idea. Okay. All right. All right, so now I want to close out with deceit and exploitation. So far we've talked about all the ways that communication leads to benefits to senders and the receivers, but it also opens up opportunities for exploitation. A nice example, and this can be intraspecific as well as interspecific. So I'm going to start out with the intra, And this example with this fiddler crab up here. So UCA, genus of fiddler crabs, deceitful, dishonest signals. These are alternative strategies that exploit an existing signaling channel through the use of misleading stimuli. Now, in the intra-specific case, this can only work if most of the time the signals are honest. And let's see how that works in this fiddler crab example. So, bluffing and fiddler crabs. So, the reason we're called fiddler crabs is the males have one gigantic claw that kind of looks like a fiddle. So, it kind of looks like they're holding a fiddle out there. So, they have this claw there. And when they mate, they wave it in the air at the female. So, if you go on a beach that has fiddler crabs, then you'll see if, I mean, you have to be real still or stand back because they run into their burrows if they see you. There'll be a female out there and there'll just be a bunch of males. And they all kind of do this sort of slow wave of this claw, this big claw up in the air. They also will signal, the males will signal to each other. And so they can, they rarely get into fights with a male that has a claw that's bigger than theirs. So they're signaling within sex, so intra-sex, as well as intersex. And so it's for mating as well as for this intra-sexual competition. So one large claw that they use for mating displays, semaphoring, remember that term, using one of your limbs for signaling, as well as in competition with male crabs, like for breeding burrows. So that's the other kind of cool thing about these fiddler crabs. This big claw means they can't mate in a female burrow. They always have to go back to his place. Because the males just don't fit. And so having a secure burrow is something that the males fight themselves for. So they not only fight for access to females, but they fight for access to burrows because they need the burrow to mate, because if they're out on the sand, they get eaten by birds and things like that. But they can't go into the female's burrow because she doesn't have two giant claws. So they just would get stuck if they go into her burrow with their big claw outside the burrow. So kind of a fun thing there. So they compete for burrows. It's all about these big claws. Now, occasionally they lose a claw. I mean, they're just invertebrates. They get broken off. There's a bunch of things that can happen. You can drop a claw, and so on. So crabs, you know, they could drop that claw. So when they lose the claw they lose grows back as a tiny claw, and the existing tiny claw, as they molt, grows into another big claw. So they can keep growing these big claws. Now, most of the time, it's a real claw that grows back. But occasionally, a fake claw grows back. So occasionally, you get a bluffing claw where the claw that comes back is this hollow, brittle thing that if you just squeeze it a little bit, it shatters. It is, doesn't have any meat in it, but it's all cuticle. It looks like a claw. And so this is referred to as bluffing. So when two males are competing for the same burrow, almost always the one with the slightly bigger claw wins the battle before they even get into a fight. They just the one with the littler claw will just turn away, and the one with the bigger claw will go down in there. But in the rare case where the one with the littler claw steps up, if the one with the bigger claw is bluffing, it will either run away, or if it gets into a fight, it loses that claw. So there is a potential for the bluff to be called, but most of the time, you don't actually get a bluffing claw. It's because it depends upon these claws normally being sturdy that allows for the cheats, the sneakers to come in and then bluff. So that's the idea here, is that we can get bluffing claws, but that only works if most of the crabs don't bluff. Once everybody bluffs, then you just don't trust a big claw anymore. So that's kind of the interesting thing. And that's the reason why you don't actually observe much of this type of exploitation in nature, because it's not stable. Once it gets above a small amount, like it's kind of like I mean, the people I know who study this will talk about, like, you know, if everybody ran around with a loaded weapon, then the one person who ran around with a toy weapon would, it might as well be loaded. Because you know that, but at the point where everybody's running around with a toy weapon, then at that point you assume that everything's a toy weapon and you don't trust it. And that's the same sort of thing here, is that you populations can only tolerate very low levels of this type of exploitative signaling. because it works because on average, there aren't bluffs. So on average, you have honesty, and that's the reason why you get low levels of bluffing. All right. So any questions about that? What I mean by bluffing, what I mean by dishonest signaling, is it clear that this dishonest signaling, it's sort of an anomaly. It can only exist at super, super low levels, because once it gets sufficiently high, you just lose the signal entirely. Okay. All right. So that's our intra-specific example of exploitation. Now let's look at a couple of inter-specific ones before we can just turn our attention back to the midterm. So there is this thing that Tinbergen discovered called a supernormal stimulus. So the idea here is so he noticed that seagulls, if you give them different size eggs, they would attend to the eggs in proportion to the size of the egg. And so what Tinbergen did is he started giving them gigantic eggs, way bigger than you'd ever get in a seagull nest. And he got them to attend to them like more than any other egg. Like they just stopped attending to their other eggs because they got this gigantic egg that was given to them. And so this is a supernormal stimulus. It's an exaggerated version of a stimuli that causes a stronger response than the original stimulus. And so this idea can be exploited by individuals of other species to parasitize the response for their own benefit. So it might be that within this species, they are constrained by the size of their body that they can only push out eggs of certain sizes. And it's also not any benefit of the reproductive system of the bird to produce eggs that cheat this response. But if you can manage to get your own egg into the nest of a bird that responds this way, maybe you can get the other bird to take care of your offspring. That's the idea here. And it turns out that's what happens. There are birds that this is how they reproduce. So, as an example, this is a common reed warbler's nest. So, you get to build these beautiful baskets here in these reeds. These are the eggs of the common reed warbler. This is an egg of a common cuckoo. So the texture is very similar to the reed warbler. Notice that it is larger than the reed warbler. And so a cuckoo will sneak in here when mom's not around, rapidly drop off its egg inside this basket, and then leave. And then the warbler, seeing this large egg, will start attending to this large egg even more than she attends to her own eggs. And it gets even worse because a cuckoo is much bigger than a warbler. And so here's the cuckoo chick. Here's mom, the mature reed warbler. And she just goes on. She's got her reproductive ground plan. She takes care of birds that came out of her nest, and she continues to raise this cuckoo. This cuckoo eventually fledges the nest, and after fledging the nest, goes and does this to another warbler. So this is an example of, if I get my mouse back here somewhere, there it goes, brood parasitism. So that's the term I want you to pick out of this: manipulation of a host to raise the brood of another. And so there's all of this, this stimuli that is used as internal regulation of reproduction, of taking care of your own brood. And it's sort of internal signaling. It's how the warbler communicates with herself. It's how her reproductive system coordinates the development of these offspring. And that's being exploited by this addition, this other bird that has effectively gotten rid of taking care of its own offspring and offloads it onto others. Social insects do this too. There are ants that will manage to get their offspring in their brood into the nests of other ants, and they get raised by those other ants. There are social insects that are now, they've lost all of their workers. Now they are just produce queens, and those queens and males, and then those queens produce offspring that are produce more queens, and they either have to kill the queens of others and then take over their workforce, or find a way to get their brood into the broods of others. And so this brood parasitism across wide ranges of animal taxa, not just birds, there's a large number of animals that have given up the ability to raise their own offspring by exploiting the ability of others to raise their offspring, brood parasitism. Questions about that? It's all from manipulating information, manipulating communication. Other interspecies examples, not quite as exploitative, cleaner fish, for example. So occasionally you do have signals that, again, we're not exploiting here. This is not a deception case here, but there are fish like these cleaner fish that provide services to these so-called client fish. So these really big fish, they normally eat fish that are about the size of these cleaner fish. And these cleaner fish then, they though, will provide a service to these big fish. They'll go and they'll remove dead skin, ectoparasites, infected tissue. And so again, providing a service. Now, they could themselves take a bite out of the big fish, and that would be a bad thing. That would be a cheat. But they generally, the cleaner fish do not end up taking a bite out of the big fish. And they use these bright blue stripes to advertise on the market that they are cleaner fish and they're sort of promising not to bite back. And they're sort of hoping in exchange the big fish won't eat them and it'll be a mutualistic relationship here. So the bright blue stripes, and residents at cleaning stations help signal willingness to provide the service to clients. But the thing is that there's an honesty issue here. Like, what's keeping this signal working? There isn't a cost that's being paid to produce this signal. Any other fish could produce this signal, and those fish could not be, true cleaners. They could just be hiding from the big fish, or they might take a bite out of the big fish. And if that were to happen, then these big fish would eventually learn this blue stripe was not a mark, something that they should trust, and they would start attacking fish that had that blue stripe. So it's a lot harder to maintain this type of advertisement. It's much more market-based. So in this case here, it's not a costly signal. It's a signal that tends to get associated with a particular type of fish, and it's maintained by the ability of the client to punish those that use the branding in kind of a bad way. So, you trust that particular brand. The one time the brand doesn't work well to you, then even though you've had, 25 years of really liking that particular brand, you never buy that brand again. And that's what kind of keeps the brand honest, the signal honest. And that's kind of the same thing with these bright blue stripes. That's the idea there. So, another example of interspecific signaling, but not maintained via cost, maintained via market signals, market pressures. All right. So that's the end of communication. So any questions about any of those topics? The big things that I want you to take away from here are the tools that we use. So encoding, bits, I want you to know about runaway selection, handicaps and costs. Brood parasitism, supernormal stimulus, those are kind of fundamentals as well. Looking forward there. And I do have one last clicker question, but any questions about any of that stuff? All right, so looking forward, midterm review on Thursday, stage one and stage two next week. So let's close with this last question. All right, so what is brood parasitism? Is it ectoparasites living on the outside of eggs? Is it manipulating a host to raise another's offspring? Is it offspring failing to leave a nest after reaching maturity? Or is it stealing and eating the other's brood? And that's all I've got for you. So we'll see you Thursday for the review.